two works of speculative fiction by women.
Once I had the idea to try to write about this, you know, huge global catastrophe, the only voice that sort of felt right was the woman looking back on a time when she was so young and something so drastic happened in the world. And I think there was something maybe especially poignant about writing about a child in a time when the entire world is under threat.
That's Karen Thompson Walker. We talked to her today about her acclaimed debut novel, Age of Miracles. It's about what happens to one young girl, her family, and her world when the Earth's rotation slows down.
I feel like everybody in my stories is using animals as self-reflection. So the animals may have motive or motivation or intent ascribed to them, or they may be sort of like the fox and the fox woman. They may be have human characteristics, but they are looking at the line between human and animal and trying to see themselves.
And that's Kidge Johnson. Drew Adamek talks with her about her new short story collection, At the Mouth of the River of Bees. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When I was growing up, speculative fiction, or sci-fi as it used to be called, was a genre dominated by men. Yes, there was the great Ursula K. Le Guin, who I'll be talking with, by the way, later in the season. Later on, Octavia Butler joined a small but noteworthy sorority. And mainstream authors like Marge Piercy, Margaret Atwood, and Doris Lessing wrote classics of the genre. But now, women in the genre are now becoming as celebrated as their male peers, even, like my guest Karen Thompson Walker, having their books snapped up with huge advances after bidding wars by publishers. Thompson Walker's debut novel, Age of Miracles, collected over $1 million in advances. What's all the excitement about? Well, for one thing, her book is beautifully written. But I suspect that the Age of Miracles garnered so much interest from publishers because it's about something we all feel weighing on our minds, whether we admit it or not, the end of the world as we know it. The novel tells an apocalyptic allegory. A giant earthquake has slowed the rotation of the earth, and the slowing is progressive and inexorable. It threatens species extinction, the breakdown of society, the dying of much of the human race, and the weakening of the very gravitational pull that holds everything together. With unbearable poignancy, the story is told in the dispassionate voice of Julia, a woman looking back to her early adolescence when the slowing began. At that time, Julia was turning 12, with all the promise that entails and the fragility of that promise in the face of global disaster. She falls in love, she witnesses the erosion of her parents' marriage, and she tries to make sense of a world that no longer makes any sense at all. Prior to the publication of The Age of Miracles, Karen Thompson Walker worked in publishing for Simon & Schuster. The Age of Miracles is published by Random House. Well, Karen Thompson Walker, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, this is a combination coming-of-age and apocalyptic novel that's absolutely haunting, and I think even more haunting because of that combination. First of all, just start out and tell our listeners the broad outlines of the plot.
Okay, sure. It's the story of a young girl and her family who wake up one morning to some really alarming news, which is that the rotation of the Earth has suddenly started to slow down. So the book is really the story of this gradually unfolding worldwide catastrophe, but it's also just as much a story about this young girl, Julia, and her process of growing up.
Yeah, and as I said, it's this combination. I think and write all the time about, the slow-motion environmental apocalypse that's upon us as we speak. And I kept on thinking about this is a young girl who is old enough to know what's happening and yet has her whole life ahead of her, and who knows how long that's going to be. Is that why you chose somebody this young to write about under these circumstances?
You know, I didn't entirely map it all out, you know, when I started writing the book, but I know that once I had the idea to try to write about this, you know, huge global catastrophe, the only voice that sort of felt right was of a woman looking back on a time when she was so young and something so drastic happened in the world. And I think it's partly because I'm sort of fascinated by adolescence, and I feel like I remember it more vividly than a lot of other times in my life. So it was satisfying to write about it, but I think there was something maybe especially poignant about writing about a child in a time when the entire world is under threat, and then it was a way of making this huge story feel hopefully a little more intimate than it might otherwise, you know, because you really are in the daily life of this young girl.
And I read someplace that the Age of Miracles actually refers to her age, not what's happening, not the catastrophe that's happening.
Yeah, I mean, in my mind, I hoped that it would figuratively refer to both, you know, both the age of adolescence and also this sort of age in terms of, you know, an era in the history of the planet when something, you know, very drastic and catastrophic has happened. But it is a line in the book, and when it's in the book, it's referring to middle school. And the reason I use that phrase, the Age of Miracles, is I had the idea that middle school is a time when such radical change takes place, you know, in people's emotions and bodies, but also the social landscape. And it's just a time when everything seems new and changes at a rate that seems almost impossible. And so I thought of miracle in a sort of loose sense as an event or a series of events that take place that seem to break with the rules of reality as we understood them before that. And I think for Julia and for, I think, a lot of kids, adolescents can sort of feel that way, as a time where things they previously thought were impossible are suddenly happening every day.
Mm-hmm. And certainly some things are now happening that nobody thought were going to happen.
In the world, certainly the slowing of the rotation of the Earth and a lot of all the consequences that follow are maybe sort of negative miracles in a way, you know, things that would have seemed impossible, like, you know, mass die-offs or changes in plants and animal behavior. And of course, the light and the darkness are completely out of sync in a way that is definitely extraordinary, and like I said, maybe a sort of negative miracle.
And gravity becomes different as well. I mean, such a fundamental constant in our lives, that becomes different. Talk a little bit about the science. Well, first, actually, say, where did this idea come from?
I got the idea from something I read in the newspaper back in 2004, shortly after the earthquake that caused the tsunami in Indonesia. And I read that earthquake was so powerful that it really affected the rotation of the Earth. And the result was that the length of our 24-hour day was just ever so slightly shorter after that, you know, a fraction of a second per day shorter. And I didn't know that was possible. I just was really struck by that and sort of frightened a little by the fact by the idea that something that I always assumed was constant, you know, the exact and predictable rising and setting of the sun, the idea that was actually in flux, even if only by a very slight degree, it was really haunting to me. And I just immediately started to wonder what would happen if something much, much more severe were to change in the rotation of the planet. So that was the first kernel. And then as I wrote the book, I mean, it was very important to me that it feel realistic and convincing, even though it, of course, involves this very unlikely event. But so for that reason, I did scientific research along the way. And then I certainly took some liberties as well, especially because, you know, no one knows for certain what would happen in this scenario. But then when I had a full draft, I showed it to an astrophysicist, which was a fascinating, though slightly scary, experience. And he helped me fix a few things. And I'd say in general, though, I was relieved by how much of it he felt was plausible once you take this major leap that's something that we don't expect and astrophysicists don't expect to happen has suddenly and mysteriously happened, which is the sudden slowdown of the rotation of the Earth.
And you have species die off. That's one thing I wondered about. Why would other species die off, but people not?
Oh, well, that's a good question. I wanted to write about a catastrophe that humans don't quite understand. And so in the book, scientists are, you know, sort of in the background, are racing to try to understand the consequences on plants and animals and ecosystems, but they don't quite understand it. And so some species, like you say, are more affected than others. So certainly plants are affected pretty quickly, and that it came from a certain amount of research and a certain amount of just the logic of imagination, I guess I'd say, just because plants are so dependent on the cycle of night and day, you know, on how much sunlight they get each day. It seems likely, and it was, you know, supported by a certain amount of research, that plants and trees would be drastically affected. So that's the first thing that happens, or one of the first things that happens. But certain animal species, especially birds, are affected in a drastic way, and in a way that scientists don't quite understand. So they begin to fall from the sky, and it could be because of the slight change in gravity has sort of messed with their flying ability, or it could be their circadian rhythms that they aren't eating and sleeping properly, or it could be something, some third not yet understood cause. But there was something about, for me, about writing about these frightening consequences that the humans also can't explain, that felt especially, I don't know, haunting and meaningful, rather than having the humans understand everything that's happening. So it takes longer for the humans to be affected, but some of them do come down with a mysterious syndrome that is clearly related to this drastic change, but again, doctors and scientists aren't quite able to pinpoint the cause, you know, whether it has to do with, perhaps it also has to do with circadian rhythms, but it's something that throughout the book they're trying to figure out.
And you call it gravity sickness.
That's right, yeah. Because possibly one of the sort of background theories is that it's the slight change in gravity that is making some people sick.
And, you know, what makes it so haunting here, part of what makes it so haunting is the very mysteriousness of this catastrophe. Its unexpectedness, as you write, I think it's on page 29, you say, it was unexpected. We had worried over the wrong things, that it's never what you worry over that comes to pass in the end. The real catastrophes are always different, unimagined, unprepared for, unknown.
Right. Yeah, there was something about something about that is even more frightening to me than the catastrophes that we do worry about. And I think it's certainly true just in our lives. And so to write about this huge, almost beyond, something that's almost so large, such a catastrophe that it's so large that people can't even quite wrap their minds around it, there's something kind of interesting and, I don't know, just striking about exploring a catastrophe that was not one of the ones that we all worry about.
Yeah, and it certainly made me think even more so about the ones that we do worry about, because it has an emotional impact. And talking about the emotional impact, let's talk now about the actual stories in the book, the characters that are in it. You focus, of course, the main character is this young girl who is just about to turn 12. Julia, tell us a little bit about her. What kind of a person is she?
Okay, so she, obviously, as you say, she's a young girl. She's an only child, and I was an only child, so I think, you know, she's certainly not exactly based on me, but there's certain emotional memories that I have that I tried to sort of use as I imagined what her life and her feelings are like at that age. But so she's an only child, which I think makes her perhaps especially observant. You know, she's used to being sort of, she's close with her parents, but yet she's the only child in the house. So there's a feeling of, she's sort of accustomed to being just slightly on the outside of that family dynamic, just because she's the child and they're the two adults. And that's something that carries over a little bit in her social situations at school. She's a little quiet, a little reserved, and very sensitive. And then, you know, when she's telling the story, she's actually much older, but she's, you know, she's an adult, but she's looking back in very fine detail on this incredibly and profoundly important time in her life.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Karen Thompson Walker about her novel, The Age of Miracles. So the impact of this world catastrophe is very different on the different people in the book, particularly in her own family. Her mother, her mother's attitude is quite different than her father's, and she's kind of watching this. I think she takes more after her father in this. Talk a little bit about what does this shine a light on in terms of what you're writing about in this book, how different people take this catastrophe to heart.
Yeah, it seemed, as I was trying to figure out how people would respond to this such a huge catastrophe, it seemed realistic that different people would respond in different ways, even within the same family. So Julia's mother is sort of prone to worry and panic before the slowing begins. So, of course, when something, probably the most frightening thing that she's ever faced or anyone has ever faced, or one of the most frightening, when that happens, her mother is... It just ratchets up her anxiety that much more, and she becomes sort of obsessed and just frightened about what the future holds. And she begins to, hoard supplies of canned food and water in case things, deteriorate as the slowing progresses. And Julia's father, on the other hand, I think that he feels that the change is almost so large that they can't, anything they could do to prepare is not enough in a way, so that it almost doesn't make sense to obsessively worry about it, and that the only thing to do is just try to move forward. That's the way I thought of him as a character. So sometimes it maybe is almost a form of denial about the seriousness, but it is a way of just moving forward in life. Although at the same time, I think it leads him to ends up pulling away from Julia's mother as a result of their different, or partly as a result of their such different reactions to the slowing.
And then in a larger sense, there are very different reactions. I mean, the government, I thought this was a really wonderful note that you introduce in this book. The government decides it's going to treat things as if nothing has changed, and it imposes clock time on people. What are you saying here? Talk about what the government does and then what the rebels do.
Well, so as soon as the rotation of the Earth starts to slow down, the first consequence is that our 24-hour clocks no longer correspond to the length of a day on Earth. So that's a problem, or it's going to take some sort of adapting immediately. And after a few weeks, the government decides that it's just chaos to not have a set, 24-hour or some kind of set clock schedule. So they decide that that everyone should just stick to the 24-hour clock, as you said, to preserve order, just to have for transportation, for work days, for school days. So they impose this 24-hour clock, but it means that the clocks and people's daily lives are now completely out of sync with the rising and the setting of the sun. So some days children are going to school in the dark. Some days they're sleeping there the entire night is in daylight. And so sometimes whole days pass in the darkness. So that, in a way, I think, to some people, feels like a certain stranger chaos than the chaos of a unpredictable rising and setting of the sun. And so, as soon as I made the decision that the government was going to impose this artificial clock on everyone, I knew that some people would resist that and they wouldn't abide by it. And so, those people I named the real timers, and they're, some of them are religious people who want to keep to their Sabbath, both Jewish and Christian people, because they want to keep track of the seventh day, seventh sunrise is still sacred to them, even though that doesn't correspond anymore with society's 7-day week. But a lot of people are just people who are more in favor of doing things the natural way, or more in favor of organic, slow, natural living rather than artificial modern life, as it's become in the book. So these people, the real timers, are completely out of sync with the clock timers. They're literally living different days, and they, in the end, can't really coexist. The real timers can't go to school. They can't work the same hours, and so a real breach opens up between them. And I think both groups are suspicious of each other, and that just felt like something true to our real world, especially in times of extreme fear. I think groups are even more likely to splinter and then become, skeptical and hostile toward one another.
You know, it also seemed to me that it was almost a metaphor of our government, you know, the way in which we are more and more out of sync, out of tune with the natural world.
Yes, I agree. I think that's right. And how our entire way of modern life, in a way, for most of us, depends on being out of sync with the natural world. I mean, in a way that's sort of creepy.
Yeah, exactly. And so let me ask you, why this is a work of speculative fiction. One could even say science fiction, because it does involve scientific issues, although not yet space exploration. Mm-hmm. Why did you want to write a novel like this? Did you want to write something that was about how does the world confront its end? Or was it more a way to get at some of the psychological, you know, the fascination with how do we react to the psychology of such events?
You know, it really started with just something kind of small but concrete, which was just a what if, you know, what if the rotation of the Earth suddenly slowed down? So as I wrote the book, it was through the writing that I discovered, you know, sort of what the book would really be about and what kinds of issues I would get to explore. And those things, you know, whether it's family dynamics in a time of crisis, the government reaction, splinters in society, all of those things, and an exploration of the effects on the natural world, all of those things I just feel like kind of grew out of that initial kernel, that initial what if. So I didn't set out to write. It wasn't like I was trying to think of an idea for a speculative fiction novel, but it was a real learning experience and a real pleasure to set out and try to do it.
And this is your first book. You've had phenomenal success with it. And in fact, you had phenomenal advances. You had a bidding war over this. Is that right?
In the UK, there was an auction, and in the US, it happened a little bit differently, but I also felt very fortunate. So I it was a rare and lucky outcome.
And did this surprise you? I mean, you've been in publishing for a long time. I'm sure we talked with Juno Diaz a few weeks ago, and he talked about how difficult it is just to make a living as a writer, even a writer like himself who is quite successful. Why do you think a book like this, with this theme, aside from the fact that it is beautifully written, why do you think it sparked such interest?
I mean, to say I was surprised, especially because I worked in book publishing, and I know how hard it is to publish a book at all, especially a first novel. To say I was surprised, I think would probably be an understatement. It's more like I was more shocked, and I never expected to write a book that would generate, you know, that kind of interest. And so it was obviously a really wonderful but really shocking outcome. And it's hard, I don't know, it's hard for the author, I think, ever to say exactly what other people see in the book. I mean, the only thing I can say is that I did notice as I was writing the book, once in a while, if I mentioned the premise to a friend, or once I mentioned it to my boss, and I sort of could see in their eyes that they immediately began to be curious about what really would happen if the rotation of the Earth slowed down. So I felt at a certain point like it was an idea that would interest people, but I never knew if I would be able to kind of pull off a successful novel from it. So I'm glad that people are interested in the idea.
We're talking with Karen Thompson Walker about her debut novel, The Age of Miracles. And as a debut novelist, a first-time novelist, what were the challenges that you faced when you were writing it?
I mean, you know, every day there's a new challenge in the actual, you know, the actual writing of it. I think maybe for me, one of the biggest challenges, though, was just finding the time to write this book. I was working full-time at the time, and the only time I could find was in the early mornings before I went to work. So I was writing it sort of hour by hour, you know, 45 minutes or an hour each morning. So the progress felt very slow, and I sometimes worried I was never going to finish it. So that, I think that was one of the biggest challenges. And then, of course, just figuring out how to write a story that can carry over, you know, a longer a longer term was a big challenge. Before I got to a certain point with this novel, I was only writing stories, and I had the feeling that maybe I wasn't sure I could ever figure out how to write a novel, how to, like I said, generate a story that is long enough, like with a certain kind of width and length that can carry a novel. So that was just a day by day learning process.
And what did you find did carry you along?
it was bit by bit. I was working in book publishing at the time the whole time that I wrote the book. And I do think I learned something from, I was editing a lot of nonfiction and learning to edit nonfiction and learning about these larger structures, you know, chapter structures and, you know, 100 or 200 page sections, and how an arc can move through from the beginning to the end of a whole book. So I think that was helpful. I don't know. I mean, now when I think of writing a novel, and I slowly came to this idea as I wrote The Age of Miracles, is that there have to be small arcs, you know, within the novel, but at the same time, those small arcs need to always be moving the larger arc further along. So I picture it almost sort of visually as a structure. At least that's the way it's worked for me, sort of interlocking arches with a larger arch over the top.
And who are your inspirations as a writer?
Some of the books that I thought of most as I was writing this book were The Virgin Suicides by Jeffrey Eugenides, Blindness by Jose Saramago, The Road by Cormac McCarthy, Housekeeping and Gilead by Marilyn Robinson are some of my favorites, and the short stories of Jhumpa Lahiri. Those are probably some of the ones that I think of most often.
And do you think that this is a genre you want to continue in, speculative fiction, or is the genre less important than the issues you want to tackle?
I think I might write more in this sort of vein. I mean, for me, what I do find kind of inspiring and interesting is imagining people facing an extreme situation. And so far, those the situations that I've been most interested in that sense, have had a certain speculative element, you know, like The Age of Miracles does. So I don't know if I'll always write that way, but what I'm working on now has a somewhat similar, it's in a sort of similar vein.
And we do live in an apocalyptic time.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel a little apocalyptic. And as I wrote the book, I was picking up a lot of details from our real newspapers, you know, especially stories about what's happening to the natural world and various species. So,
yeah, and that's what does make it so haunting. I mean, this is a book that really stayed with me for quite a while in thinking about it. It's The Age of Miracles, and it's just an absolutely wonderful book.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Karen Thompson-Walker, for talking with us here.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Karen Thompson-Walker. You can read an excerpt from The Age of Miracles by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, Drew Adamek interviews Kate Johnson about her collection of speculative short fiction, At the Mouth of the River of Bees. It's out from Small Beer Press. Stay tuned after the break.
Today I am a small blue thing, like a marble or an eye, with my knees against my mouth, I am perfectly round. I am watching you. I am cold against your skin. You are perfectly reflected. I am lost inside your pocket. I am lost against your fingers. I am falling down the stairs. I am skipping on the sidewalk. I am thrown against the sky. I am raining down in pieces. I am scattering like light. Scattering like light. Scattering like light. Today Today I am a small blue thing, made of china, made of glass. I am cool and smooth and curious. I never blink. I am turning in your hand, turning in your hand. I am cold against your skin. You are perfectly reflected. I am lost inside your pocket. I am lost against your fingers. I am falling down the stairs. I am skipping on the sidewalk. I am thrown against the sky. I am raining down in pieces. I am scattering like light, scattering like light, scattering.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Earlier in the show, I talked with Karen Thompson Walker about her speculative fiction novel, The Age of Miracles. Now let's hear Writer's Voice's Drew Adamek talk with another emerging female voice in the field of speculative fiction, Kiz Johnson.
This week on Writer's Voice, I talked to Kiz Johnson about her first short story collection, At the Mouth of the River of Bees, a compelling and fascinating blending of styles and blurring of genres, with stories ranging from hard science fiction to magic realism to speculative fiction. The stories of At the Mouth of the River of Bees feature strong female characters, often in isolation, facing spiritual crisis and suffering with dignity and ultimately triumph. In the course of her career, Johnson has won multiple awards for her writing, including 3 consecutive Nebula Awards. She now teaches fiction writing at the University of Kansas as an assistant professor. I spoke to Kiz about her new collection, the challenges women face in science fiction, and what new writers should do to break into the business. Thank you so much for joining us, Kiz.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
On the simplest level, what is At the Mouth of the River of Bees about?
It's a collection of 17 or 18 stories that are fantasy, science fiction, slipstream, some irreal fiction, and some that is just realistic. It's mimetic fiction, all different lengths, because I like to write different lengths, but there's certain themes that just run through everything. The stories are all really about people engaging with themselves, often through the medium of animals, and or the medium of the environment, the world they find themselves in. And they're often isolated people in one way or another, but they're always looking for bridges into either self-awareness or into someone else.
So for new readers to your work, how would you describe your writing to them?
I guess I would say I try for clarity, and apart from that, I don't really have a category that I aim for. I just try different things every time I do a new short story, and I usually end up with something not quite like anything else I've done.
One of the things that really struck me about this collection, and the thing that I enjoyed most, is that there's such a broad range of what feels like different genres. It's a hard sci-fi, fantasy, magic realism. How do you go about finding those kinds of different stories and different styles to write in?
Oh, thank you. I did not start as a writer. I started as a reader, and I read everything. And I think that that really has flavored what I want to write, because I'm not interested in restricting myself. I'm not in this to make a lot of money, so I don't have the same sort of constraints into a particular genre that people are used to with my name. And so I can just try anything I like, and I can try it in as complicated a manner as I like. That means that I have tried to write a bit of everything, and every time I think I've settled down, the next story is always a challenge. I always pick a different content challenge or a different style challenge. And so far, I really have tried to do different things just about every time since the first half dozen stories or so that I wrote.
And this collection, while it has different styles, really feels to me like it has a common thread throughout, that there's a commonality in all of these stories. How did you go about putting this collection together and assembling it?
The commonality, it is, I see that I write about animals a lot. And I, to me, they're very interesting because they are aliens that we live with, and they're almost a perfect mirror that we can use to look at ourselves as people. And that works by extension into aliens, but for me, mostly, I stay pretty close to home, and I stay with animals, and animals that I know a fair amount. But as far as putting the collection together, I didn't think of that, and the last few short stories I've been writing have not been about animals. So what I've been doing is, when I put it together, basically I picked every story I liked, and I rewrote two of them, and the rest were just the stories that I was pleased by, and I sent it all to Gavin, and he suggested a different order, and I think that helped a lot, because I think that made it much more organic than my original proposal.
And Gavin is your publisher?
Yes, Gavin Grant at Small Beer Press, and he has been wonderful.
These stories have almost exclusively female leads or female characters in them. Science fiction has tended to be male-dominated. Have you felt a resistance to this female-centric writing?
Well, that's interesting. I think that because I don't write science fiction most of the time, and by science fiction I mean sort of harder science fiction, speculative science fiction, I don't think I run up against the same challenges that somebody writing science fiction with women protagonists might as often. But actually, Man Who Bridged the Mist was me saying, I write women all the time. Can I get inside a man's mind and write a story with a male protagonist? So I've been thinking a lot about that just lately and whether I want to explore that further.
There's a real sense in all of these stories that these characters, while they're in different places and in different times and in even in written in different genres, they're experiencing sort of the same things. They're having the same kinds of struggles. Can you describe what these characters throughout the collection are struggling with, or is that too broad of a question?
I could not have answered that a year ago, but other people who read it will tell me things that they think it's about, and I'll go, yeah, that's totally it. So one of those things is that people have talked about how so many of my stories are about isolation. Somebody said it's like gazing into the abyss. They all gaze into the abyss, and then they all step back. And I think those are not wrong. I think I do write about people who are essentially alone or lonely or solitary, and the ways that they strive for communication with mixed success.
Funny you mention isolation, because that was my next question, in that the settings of most of these places are very isolated, whether it's in an Alaskan wilderness or a shipwrecked space capsule. These are characters who are struggling in almost total isolation. But there's a real, for me, it felt like there was a real spiritual dimension to this, that they're arguing or they're struggling with their callings or the calling of a higher spirit.
Yeah, that's interesting. To my mind, they're all asking some fundamental questions, and I think those questions are the same no matter who people are, and so I think they're often the same no matter which character it is. I know that a lot of times my characters end up in isolation, and even the ones that are in sort of busy communities like 26 Monkeys Also the Abyss, the character Amy is in a fair, and she lives with 26 monkeys and a boyfriend. And despite all of that, she's essentially alone. So even when characters are in the middle of things going on. Or Kit, who's the protagonist of The Man Who Bridged the Mist, he is in the middle of a huge construction project, so he has hundreds and hundreds of people around him, and yet he also is essentially isolated. So I think that's an important thing for me. As far as the sort of higher sense, it's maybe because I'm always asking myself questions about what is my purpose? Why is it that I or anybody else does step back from the abyss?
I want to explore a little further this role of animals in your work, because a lot of these stories are so tied into animals and relationships with animals. Can you talk about the relationship that these characters have with animals?
I feel like everybody in my stories is using animals as self-reflection. So the animals may have motive or motivation or intent ascribed to them, or they may be sort of like the fox and the fox woman. They may be have human characteristics, but they are looking at the line between human and animal and trying to see themselves. And I think that works both ways, because the fox and fox woman, she actually wants to become human, and so she's always looking at herself and saying, what about me is not human? It's a, I think, all the time about kind of the ways that we interact with animals. It's become a real topic for me over, you know, in my life as well as in my writing.
This is Writer's Voice. I'm Drew Adamack, and I'm speaking with Kids Johnson about her new collection, At the Mouth of the River of Bees. There are elements in these stories that I just found so beautiful, and it's the single telling detail that I just was so struck by, where an alien ocean calls a young college girl. Monkeys appear in and out of a bathtub, this sort of isolated rescue craft in the middle of space. In speaking about your writing process, how much do you build around these details, or do they, are these details the genesis of these stories, or are they?
Yes, exactly. And I have a hard time when I'm teaching writing, because I teach here at the University of Kansas, but I teach elsewhere as well, because people are always asking, does a story come from plot, or does it come from character, or what does it come from? And for me, it always comes from one glowing moment or one glowing image. And that is what kicks me off. 26 Monkeys, also The Abyss, the words, the notion of monkeys and gazing into the abyss were two things that were given to me when I was asking for a challenge on a online journal. But the bathtub full of monkeys, which is kind of the heart of it all, I have no idea where that came from, but that was one of the very first things to come to me, and the first sentence of the story came first. Elsewhere, there's often a sense of, there's a single thing, like the At the Mouth of the River of Bees is just a meditation on the way the West is so strange and the way rivers have the oddest names. And you know that a river is named the Bee River or the Powder River or something like that because of one instance. Somebody rode by it on a horse and said, there's no water in this river. What I see is dust, and it looks like powder. So I call it the Powder River. And the Bee River, presumably one person looked at that river and said, there's a pile of bees here, you know, goes by a hive or something. And just the magic of naming an entire thing because of an instant that you observed, that's what got me going on At the Mouth of the River of Bees. And then all the other things, the woman with the dying dog and just the traveling overland, those were secondary to that first idea, that first image.
So talk about your writing process a little bit in the difference between spontaneity and plan, because you mentioned earlier that you wanted to switch genres every time that you wrote a story, and yet you really take, you seem to take these moments of instantaneous insight or imagery and turn them into stories. How do you balance those two?
The idea of sort of discipline, craft, and organization in contrast to creativity and the illuminating instance, I guess I might call it, those two are always sort of wrestling it out. And depending on which story I'm writing, one comes to the fore more than the other. So like with At the Mouth of the River, or I'm sorry, the other one, The Man Who Breached the Mist, as soon as I got it going with that image of the glowing mist, everything after that, just that's all figuring it out. That's all intellectual craft decisions. And it ends up being about much more than that, because it's hard to write something that long and not be about more than events. But that's a case where discipline and planning ahead and structuring it around something was essential. Some of that's because it's long. The very short pieces I write, a lot of times there is a sense to them. There is a structure or an organizing principle, but they're not organized in the same way. So they may be more driven by momentary inspiration, sort of from scene to scene even.
I loved this line, and I'm going to say it again. I'm paraphrasing from one of the stories, but a character felt it in her bones, either like true love or cancer. And there seems to be in these characters, a lot of these characters, an ambiguity about the callings or the experiences that they're having. How are you wrestling with these sort of ambiguities within these stories?
I don't think anything is simple. And the very earliest two stories in there are wolf trapping and fox magic. And those two stories I wrote as a result of attending Clarion West long, long ago. And even those stories, and that was less than a year after I had started writing that I produced the earliest draft of those two, I felt that there was no easy way to organize experience. Nothing is simple. Love is not simple once you're more than 14. Death is not simple. Commitment is not simple. War and peace. Nothing is clear after a certain age or a certain amount of self-awareness. And to my mind, that's exactly where I like to write, is the notion that you really cannot know. There's a place like in 26 Monkeys, Also the Abyss, where I step outside of the story and I say, nothing is certain. And when you are a certain age or have had certain experiences, Amy's grief will make a terrible poison dark sense. And to my mind, that's exactly what happens in life. The more complicated we get, the more complicated it gets. So I'm always thinking about that in my own life, and I can't not think about it in writing.
I want to ask about a couple of the stories specifically, because they were so striking to me. The first story, if you could talk about a little bit, because it's such a shocking story and such a memorable story for me, is Spar, in which a woman is trapped in sexual congress with an unidentified alien being. Can you talk a little bit about that story within the collection?
It's interesting within the collection, because it really isn't like anything. It certainly wasn't like anything I'd written up to that date, although I've explored these short, sharp stories more in recent years. But that came out of my interest in not doing the same thing twice. Right before that, I had written a long story that's in the collection, too. It's called The Cat Who Walked 1,000 Miles. And it was originally written as a proposal for a chapbook for a young adult, or not even a young adult, but a younger reader's book. But it came out much too long for that, and also sort of changed as I wrote it. But the whole, it was G-rated, and it was sweet, and it was a long, leisurely story. And after that, I thought, I've been writing a lot of pretty fiction lately, because right before that, I had written At the Mouth of the River of Bees, and I had written Evolution of Trickster Stories, which has an immensely long title. And I thought, I need to do something different, and decided to write something that was as consciously unpretty as I could. And I had been joking with a friend right before that, saying, I'm tired of writing pretty stuff. What I need to do is write something about two people having sex in a lifeboat, because that'll be not pretty. And ended up pushing it all the way to the extreme. If that's a story that started with the first sentence as well. And then the story proceeded from there, and also the nonlinear nature of the story, which I thought was essential to tell it. In fact, it's a story that I find really unpleasant, but it's exactly the story I needed and wanted to write.
There's another almost apocalyptic story in this collection, Dia German's Tale, a story of planetary destruction told by the women who had to suffer through it, that strikes a much different tone in some ways than other stories in the collection. Can you talk about that story in particular?
That story came from a different inspiration and a different direction than any of the others. It was a response. Chris McKitterick is a science fiction writer, and he had an unpublished novel, which is presumably going to be published at some point in the not-too-distant future, called Empire Ship. And the story was disturbing. It was being told by the men of the ship. And I thought, there's another story here. There's another very unpleasant, difficult, challenging story to be told here. And Chris kindly said, write it. Go ahead and do it. So that came out initially as me attempting to come to my own sense of understanding of what the life, what the world was like. And so while his story does not talk about what happens on the planet, mine did. And my story, as a result, turns out to be really completely different than his, although the situation is still the same. So that was a case where I was responding directly to somebody else's fiction. And I'm so glad you called that out, because I actually really liked that story.
I'm Drew Adamack, and this is Writer's Voice, and we're talking to Kiz Johnson, author of At the Mouth of the River of Bees. I want to go back to something you said earlier, this idea that you are not interested in writing for money necessarily, but that you're writing about what you're interested in writing about, and you're writing what you're interested in reading about. What advice would you give to a beginning writer? Because all of the advice now seems to be, pick a genre, brand yourself, become this kind of writer. And yet you've done almost the opposite of that.
Yeah. I think my advice for new writers is, the obvious easy answer is, oh, write for yourself. And the second easiest answer is, oh, you know, market yourself, brand yourself, blah, blah, blah. But I think the real answer is, figure out exactly what your goal is. Because we do not always think about our goal as we start writing. But there is one. No matter how sort of spiritual you are about it or how pragmatic you are, there is a goal underneath everything that is what's driving you. And usually it's an immediate goal, and usually it's not what anybody would expect. And here's an example from my life, that my initial goal for writing was, because I come from a family where people are publishers. My grandparents were publishers. My parents were editors. They also had other jobs, but I wanted to write something that would end up, my mom was also a librarian. I wanted to write something that would end up in a library so that my mom would see it. And of course, she's seen all my stuff, you know, in other ways, but underneath it all, the first drive was, I'm going to write something that my mom has to read. And that has, even though everything has changed and she doesn't read a lot of my fiction because it's depressing to her, that still was a motivating force, and that colored the first 15 years of my writing. So a new writer has to look at themselves and say, what am I writing for? Am I writing for attention? Am I writing for praise? Am I writing because I must do it for self-esteem? Am I writing because I think it's going to be easier than a day job? Whatever that goal is, that's going to define what you write for and what you write, I think. So to my mind, it being as honest as you possibly can be about your intentions for your writing are going to do you more good than arbitrarily picking a goal, and especially a goal that is given to you online or given to you in an MFA program or given to you by your friends, your family. If you know your goal, then that's what's going to work.
And then do you feel like your access to audiences is restricted by perhaps a sci-fi label or a fantasy label? Because again, to me, this collection, those are just the details. These are really stories of humanity and stories of spirituality. But do you think that the labels that publishers and people like me have to put on this, does that harm your ability to reach audiences?
I think it changes the audiences that I reach. Because I think a lot of science fiction people would never pick up a collection like that was a mainstream collection. One question to ask yourself or anybody is, how often have you picked up an Amy Bender collection? She's a mainstream writer, but she writes fantasy. Or George Saunders. These are people who are writing with the other label, but would somebody within our genre, would a reader of our genre reach outside of it and read them? So I think it does change who buys my stuff or who reads it. And I think that's a pity because I think there's really interesting stuff done on both sides of the divide. I just graduated from North Carolina State University with a Master of Fine Arts. They have John Kessel as one of the instructors there, but it's not a science fiction-specific program. So I read a lot of things I had never read before, a lot of mainstream fiction, including things like Moby Dick. And I was blown away because everything you try to do in a fantasy or a science fiction novel happens in Moby Dick. I never would have read it. So I think that kind of sort of myopia goes both ways. And I think it's a good idea to be reading outside of your category, but I think an even better thing would be for the categories to be less rigid and less relevant, less important.
So what does the future hold for your writing, and how do you see yourself evolving as a writer now that this collection has been put out?
I feel like I'm changing a lot. I'm not interested in doing the same thing, as I said before. I find I need to keep changing, and right now I feel I'm starting to think more about classic storytelling again, because probably a half dozen of the stories in that collection are stories where I'm deconstructing narrative. I'm tearing it apart to see how far down you can break it and still have the story make sense. To the extreme of story kit, where you're given all of the materials to build the story, but you never actually get the story itself. And lately I've been thinking I'd like to readdress conventional narrative. And I have two more tiny broken-up stories that I'm working on right now. But once those are done, the next thing I want to work on is a classic quest structure, a journey into the land of the dead. And that'll be something I haven't done for, I don't know, a million years. Before that, I have these two final stories, both of which are actually mainstream. So that's another thing that's evolving for me, is that I'm trying more fiction that has no supernatural element. If it has anything, it has allegorical importance, and that's all it's got. So I am changing a lot, and the collection kind of gave me a chance to put a lot of things away, because now it's bound, it's pretty, now it's on the shelf, and now I can write the next book.
I've been speaking with Kids Johnson, the author of the story collection At the Mouth of the River of Bees. Thank you so much for joining us, Kids.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's great to have been able to talk.
That was Drew Adamek talking with Kids Johnson. You can read an excerpt from Johnson's short story collection At the Mouth of the River of Bees by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at writersvoice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.